This is Regionally Speaking, Reporters Roundtable Thursday here on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte, and we'll start off by talking with Meredith Kolias-Pete, who is an education reporter for the Post-Tribune. Meredith, thanks for joining us on the program today.
Sure, thanks for having me.
Well, a couple stories you have are very interesting here, and one particular follows up, I guess, the latest on a civil court case that involved a couple former school town of Munster of administrators. And bring us up to date what the matter is and how the appeal may turn out if it does.
Yeah, absolutely. Just to give a little bit of backstory, we had two former Munster school administrators, William Fitzker and then Richard Sopko. They were in Munster around 98 till kind of 2013, and what had happened is that after they kind of left, the newer school board members sort of discovered that they had are accused of setting up to be overpaid through their retirement annuity. So once everybody added everything up, it appears that they were overpaid about $840,000. This has been in the court system for several years. In 2017, Attorney General Curtis Hill sued them to get the money back. Where we stand now is last year, a Lake County Judge Marissa McDermott kind of ruled that too much time had passed between when the money was actually missing and until Munster discovered it, and Curtis Hill sued to get it back. This week, an appeals court upheld McDermott's ruling on that. So basically, we're kind of at the end of the line on this case. The next step at this point is for Curtis Hill to appeal to the Indiana Supreme Court, which he said that he will do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was wondering if he is he had talked with his attorneys that were working on the case, and they decide they're going to go ahead and get the paperwork filed there so that the high court can take a look at it. So.
Right. And kind of in a nutshell, sort of the issue here with the case is, there's a 5-year statute of limitations on the case. When did that begin? How much time does Curtis Hill have to sue? Curtis Hill is saying that, here's that period, 98 to 2013. Munster discovers it much later, 2015. Then you have them notify the State Board of Accounts, which is a public accounting agency. They're sort of in charge of looking at the books of a lot of different public agencies, and like school corporations, for example. June 2016, they filed an audit, and their finding is that, yes, these two men, received this money improperly. Curtis Hill turns around a year later and files the lawsuit. Now, Curtis Hill is saying that he should have that right, no matter how long it takes for, an impropriety to come up. Once that state account report comes out, he should have the right to sue to get back the money, whereas the courts are saying, no, that you need to go by, 5-year appeals. The two defendants are saying that the statute of limitations should have started when the money was originally sort of paid out. And that's kind of been the decision on that, if that makes sense. So basically, McDermott's ruling had set the statute of limitations to start in 2012. Here you have that time frame from 98 to 2013. So if you set the time that the state could recollect the money in 2012, that basically throws out almost the whole case. And that's kind of where we're at right now.
Have you gotten the impression, even though we know that the school town of Munster has obviously changed the leadership and superintendent several times since this all came about, but has there been any reaction or any thoughts from people who are with the school district now about this matter still not completely resolved?
Well, they don't really want to comment too much on it at this point. Their kind of attitude is that it's really been thrown to the lawyers. Back a couple of years ago when this first came out, obviously, folks in Munster were up in arms about this,
yeah.
Because they're saying that, the school board should have been watching, watching this happen. And again, something that's helping the defendant's case is that they're saying that, their argument is that, from this whole period of about 15 years where apparently these extra payments were kind of growing in size, that the Munster School Board apparently was sort of not reading the fine print and they were signing off on 15 years of this. So that's kind of something that's, kind of helping the defendant's case. Now, the current, current folks in charge have said that, since then, the whole school board has turned over, basically. You have a new superintendent, that they're watching things very closely. Unrelated, Munster had about a, $8 million deficit in recent years. They've said they've closed that at this point, and they've also passed a couple of referendums since then.
Yeah, I was going to say, they've made some changes, the serious changes. And you say, they went through a time of serious deficits, and they managed to resolve all that. So they probably, of course, they certainly would like to get this over with and get that well behind them, because it is, history-wise, is well behind them, but the problems still seem to crop up, to be sure.
Yeah, and I mean, in context, this is probably one of the largest cases that I can think of recently in, for schools in Northwest Indiana.
Yeah. One of the other schools here, in fact, in Lake County, that is making some changes, and this time we're talking here about superintendents again, is about the fact that we have a leader at Crown Point High School who's making a job change. Tell us about what Chip Pettit's going to be doing, I guess, effective Monday.
Yeah, Chip Pettit used to be the principal over at Crown Point High School, and he's got a new job, as you said, leading the Doolin School Corporation out in Chesterton. What we know, about Chip at this point is that he was a principal over at Crown Point for about 7 years or so. He, a couple years past, folks might know him actually as a football coach. He was a football coach over at Wheeler and Crown Point, the coach of a couple different sports, and also was a pretty notable athlete back in high school. He's a Crown Point native, and it looks like this is his first stint as the superintendent.
Well, it looks like that not only do we have somebody who's well-experienced, certainly in Lake County schools, and he's headed over into Porter County, and he's going to be doing his best to improve the Doolin school system over there, too. And it's interesting, too, that he's been able all the time that he's been principal at Crown Point High School to be able to keep up his education. It's tough to do to be able to work a full-time job and a job like being a high school principal to try to work on, I guess, a way eventually to become a superintendent someplace, even if it wasn't in the same district, but at least to be able to make improvements and better yourself and your education, too. So you have to take your hats off to Chip Pettit for working extra hard all the time, not only at Crown Point High School, but also, too, to be able to get his degree work. And I guess he's picking up his doctorate degree pretty soon from Ball State, if I understand.
Yeah, we understand that it's supposed to happen at the end of next month. But really, that kind of stuff is actually pretty typical, especially in the education world, where you have folks that want to be administrators and kind of move up the chain or so. You know, they take advantage, whatever it may be, of online courses, and they're, it's pretty common for folks to be, like, pursuing a doctorate while they're, while they're working. Now, I think some of the things that Chesterton said that they liked about him, obviously if anybody's familiar with Crown Point High School, it's a pretty big school. You have folks, like, directing traffic in the morning, directing traffic after school. So, pretty good size high school. One thing very commonly that schools are focusing on now is, like, getting those kids early college credits. They're called dual credits. So, when they graduate, that they have, a little bit under their belt. They say, it saves money and kind of helps them, tackle their degree faster. Also, career training, training for the trades is also, very much sort of in vogue right now in education. And so those are a couple of things that, that they really liked about his experience. One thing that really sets him up, and something that he said in the release that we got from Chesterton that, really made him, want to pursue this job, is that, of course, Doolin just very recently renewed their school referendum for another 7 years. And so the state of Indiana allows school districts, of course, to pitch that to voters if you want to raise your property taxes, and then the money goes to the school budget. That was very advantageous for Chesterton, certainly. It helps them pay the bills over there. And so that kind of puts him in a good position. Doolin, of course, is notable. It's a pretty strong school district. They basically University kind of get A's and B's from the state. And so they're definitely wanting to continue that. But as we talked about last time, this is probably the second district in recent memory where you have someone that's being promoted to a position like that and doesn't have superintendent experience, which is very interesting. Of course, we've seen that recently in Hammond with Scott Miller, and now we're seeing that in Dunland with Chip Pettit as well. And it may very well be that, you know, these districts are really looking for, like, very personable people, you know, people that have experience dealing with parents and, you know, are going to be, like, a sort of very familiar voice for the community.
Well, they certainly aren't people that have no experience in schools, because they both have extensive experience in schools and on the ground, literally, in the hallway experience, in this case at high schools. So it's going to work out well for everybody, I think. And so he'll be able to, so Chip will be able to go to any of the schools in the district when he takes over on Monday and introduce himself if he hasn't done so already and talk with the students and the teachers and the other administrators and get the feel of what these particular schools are like. And he'll fit in very quickly, to be sure. So, well, Meredith, thank you very much for spending time with us on the stories that you've had in print and online, and we appreciate it, and we hope to have you back on soon.
Sure. Thanks, Chris.
That's Meredith Colia's speech. She's an education reporter for the Post Tribune, and she was with us from the Crown Point office. It's been 5 years now since a team of greening experts worked with the city of Gary and with the residents in the Aetna neighborhood to be able to put together the city's very first big repurposing project, as they're called. Vacant to Vibrant is the project name, and the project manager, Sandra Albrose, just put out a book about her experiences when she was in the Steel City, and she was speaking with us about it.
I'm based in Cleveland, Ohio, and this is a problem that we're facing here in Cleveland. We also worked in Buffalo. So a lot of post-industrial cities throughout the Great Lakes region have these problems with vacant lots, and we're trying to figure out what to do with them. So the Aetna neighborhood of Gary was interesting because of the vacant land that they had. We received a grant from the Great Lakes Protection Fund to look at different greening strategies that could be useful for small vacant lots that are embedded among houses and residents, specifically because we were seeing other types of vacant land, like large industrial parcels being looked at, but we weren't seeing these smaller vacant lots being examined, and in some ways those can be harder to use.
I know a lot of cases you hear about the term greenfields, and that's, of course, what an EPA likes to use as a term for ones sites that have a particular amount of contamination to deal with, too, as well as being vacant. So we're not talking necessarily about contaminated sites, but we're talking about sites that have been vacant and then sore in use of the resources that are out there. How did you get involved with this project with the city of Gary? Did you find out it from them? Did you consult with them before things really got started in the Aetna neighborhood?
I did. We were hosting a series of regional discussions in around 2009, 2010, amongst professionals from different Great Lakes cities to talk about vacant lots and this overlap between community and environmental concerns that different cities were facing, and specifically how vacant lots could be repurposed in ways that helped address those needs. So the city of Gary was very active in those early discussions, and it quickly became apparent that not only was the city of Gary, you know, they had the demonstrated need, but they also had the capacity and interest to try vacant land strategies that hadn't been fully worked out yet. So they were a great partner from the start.
When you get a project like this started, even if you're at the very beginning of the process, you obviously have to consult with people at City Hall. Who did you end up talking to at first as you got things started? And then, of course, then you have to actually go into the neighborhood, wherever you're working, in this case in the Aetna neighborhood, and talk with the residents. Tell us about what cooperation you needed to get from Gary City Hall first and then from the neighbors themselves.
We've been working mostly with Brenda Scott-Henry, who is in the Department of Green Urbanism in the Gary Stormwater District. Mm-hmm. And Brenda has been a wonderful partner for years and was involved in these early discussions amongst the region. Also, someone who had previously worked in the Department of Green Urbanism, Lauren Riga, was a participant in these discussions. So that was our in at the City of Gary. They were looking at issues of stormwater management to prevent combined sewer overflow, and they also had all of these vacant parcels, and this aligned well with needs that we had identified both in Cleveland and Buffalo. Then once we got to the city of Gary, we relied on a lot. The Department of Green Urbanism has some good roots in the Aetna neighborhood, and so we worked with the department. We worked with local churches, and then we also talked a lot directly with residents. We went door to door. We held community meetings. We went to other community meetings that they were already holding, and through just a variety of methods to capture, you know, different residents and a variety of feedback, we went through a multi-month planning process with residents, hearing their concerns and their desires for their neighborhood, and then working with designers to try to translate those needs and concerns into plans for these little parcels that could help address those needs and concerns.
I know that the Environmental Resilience Institute, which is based at IU Bloomington, has worked extensively with the city of Gary and with you all, I'm sure, on this. And there are pictures that they happen to have on their Environmental Resilience Institute website that show some of the projects. I guess there are, what, three in particular, the vacant to vibrant sites that were set up in the Aetna neighborhood. What did you all take a look at first when you went into a particular neighborhood after talking with the residents, getting the input from them in that process, to take a look and see what's there and what you all and the people that have come in to do the work can actually do?
As soon as we identified Aetna as a focus in Gary, we looked at all of the vacant parcels in Aetna, and we, you know, just looked at the different characteristics of those parcels. You know, did they have houses on them? Had they been demolished? What kinds of soils were there? How many people lived around them? And what types of indicators were on the parcels that might tell us about, you know, what residents wanted from them? So, for example, a simple footpath that residents have worn down through a vacant lot could indicate that they would like a formalized path or a trail to help them get from point A to point B. And so the three parcels that we looked at and we ended up focusing on in Aetna, one of them is on a prominent corner right as you come into the neighborhood. Aetna neighborhood actually predates Gary. And so there's a lot of neighborhood pride around the name of the neighborhood and just announcing to residents or to visitors that they've arrived in Aetna. Mm-hmm. So for this prominent corner lot, we ended up coming up with a design that just was a sign of announcing the name of the neighborhood and a series of rain gardens to capture stormwater runoff and help alleviate that stormwater or the combined sewer overflow.
In some of these sites that you all took a look at and you decided to choose to use in the project, were there any houses abandoned or otherwise that were on the sites that you had to take care of first?
Yeah, because of our close relationship with the city of Gary, we were able to do something special in Gary that we couldn't do in Cleveland and Buffalo, and that was to work with the city prior to demolition. So two of the parcels that we worked on had houses. One of the houses had been vacant for 15 to 20 years, long enough that people in the community didn't remember who used to live there. And then another house had been burned out and was there for about 5 or 6 years. City was able to get federal funding to help demolish those houses, but we started working with them before the houses even came down. One of the cool things about that process is that behind one of the burnt out house, there was a really nice cinder block decorative wall and a little walled garden in the backyard. We were able to preserve that wall because we worked with the city prior to demolition, and we turned that into a walled garden that makes a nice picnic space or a good community gathering place.
Besides vacant to vibrant, the Aetna neighborhood was also been Gary's first area to be able to provide materials taken from abandoned houses and repurposed by Steel City Salvage. That was a 2017 project that was created by Chicago-based Delta Institute. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Here's Carol Carlson, who is a reporter, covers news in the Gary area and other places too, for that matter, I guess, from the Post Tribune. And Carol, thanks for joining us today. Well, the first story, one of the big stories you have up is a continuing update, I guess, on what's happening at the Gary Community School Corporation these days. And it's not, I guess, necessarily focusing in on the emergency management team, but I know that they've been keeping a very close eye on the budgets, on how much money is spent by the school district. And I guess the latest state audit bears out that they probably need to keep a closer look if they haven't been doing so already, right?
Yeah, the results of an audit that was taking place between 2016 and 2018, mid-2018, were released recently, and it's just the same kind of litany of issues that the school district has been struggling with, problems with bookkeeping and accounting and recording disbursements and record-keeping and general financial problems that continue to plague them.
Mm-hmm. I know you mentioned in your article that it was in print and online, too, that there are a couple citations that the State Board of Accounts audit made. I'm very concerned about the use of debit cards.
Right.
And I think the question is, you know, we thought that when the emergency management team came in and they had to do a lot of house cleaning, I suppose, you thought that they would have gotten all those cards in, or maybe was this some time period even before they took over?
This sounds like this was a new issuance or establishment of debit cards. It came under the former chief financial officer who was hired by the emergency manager at that time. That Peggy Hinckley was the emergency manager, and she hired Leonard Moody. So this was not something that happened under the old regime of the old Geary School Board. This was under the emergency management system, although both of those people are no longer with the district.
Yeah, that's why I know that you mentioned in the story, too, about the fact that Leonard Moody is no longer there, and nobody seems to be saying at least why he left. You know, I wonder if it's all related in some way or the other, maybe.
Personnel is one of the issues with this emergency management system. It's that there is little public accountability to determine when people come and go. We sometimes see job openings on the school district website, and then that's when we find out, oh, that principal's gone, or, you know, somebody else is gone. Because of there's just not that many public meetings, and the procedure that typically is followed by school districts where school boards approve hirings and terminations just isn't there under this system. But Leonard Moody was... we were told that he resigned back in March, and we weren't told why. We were just told it was a personnel issue, but it comes on the heels of the discovery of these debit cards that were canceled by the current emergency manager, Pete Marikas.
Now, do you think that Dr. Marikas, of course, he was going through the state audit report pretty closely, I would imagine. Were there any discrepancies, anything wrong that maybe things that shouldn't have been purchased on those debit cards?
I questioned the state auditor, Tammy White, about that.
Yeah.
And she said there were no giant red flags of personal items or anything like that. She just felt like because they could not document the establishment of these debit cards, and apparently Peggy Hinckley didn't know about them, that it was not a wise procedure in terms of accounting.
I know you also mentioned, too, in your article about the fact that the audit was very particularly stressing the fact that not only did we have these debit card issues, but also that maybe that there were some payments that were supposed to be made from payroll weren't being made in particular. Tell us about that.
Those are repeat findings. The district has been lax because of the lack of money available. They've been behind on many payments, and this was something that did start under the old regime and probably continued to this day. And we're told now that the emergency manager does have a handle on this and has submitted a plan of action to make sure that these repeat findings don't continue.
Mm-hmm. Isn't this been a problem, too, even before they end up going to the state takeover, that when it was still under the control of the regular administration, that is to say Dr. Pruitt, as well as the elected school board, that they weren't making payments on the pensions of the teachers and other staffers that were supposed to be made?
They were far behind on most payments.
Yeah.
IPSCO bill, paying their transportation operator, and most notably, of course, the IRS. Came after them and put liens on all their buildings, and they did reach a settlement with the IRS that came under the emergency manager.
One of the other stories that you also had out there, too, for view on print, in print and online, we should say, is about the final visits to the churches of the Roman Catholic Diocese of Gary of Bishop Donald Hying. He had his last mass said here this past weekend, didn't he?
Yes, he did, and he has been installed now as, I think, the fifth bishop in Madison, Wisconsin at the diocese there. That happened Tuesday.
What reaction has he gotten that you know of from folks here in Northwest Indiana of his installment as the bishop?
As the bishop in Madison?
No, in Indiana. While he was here, I suppose.
Much universal that he will be missed. And, and his accomplishments seem to be, his top accomplishment seems to be people just felt that he listened to them. And he was quite involved in activities in the neighborhood. He lived in Gary, which was a departure from past bishops. He lived right next to Holy Angels and often walked in the neighborhood and a Habitat for Humanity built a house with help of the diocese and Catholic Charities right in the neighborhood that he walked by every day. So he was only here a short time, but he did make a big impact in a positive way.
Now we know since he has gone on to his next assignment from the Vatican, who is likely to take his place as the bishop or at least the administrator for the Diocese of Gary?
Well, we should find that out any time now. I was told that either Thursday, which is today, or tomorrow, that a committee will name an administrator. This is a lay person to conduct the business of the diocese, which goes on, you know, even without a bishop. It took the Pope about 18 months to name Donald Hying the last time. So I don't think we're going to see a new bishop anytime in the near future, if that's any kind of measurement on how this works.
Well, that's, as you say, sometimes the case, the bureaucracy. It doesn't matter whether it's lay bureaucracy or whether it's, I guess, divine bureaucracy. It sometimes takes a while to accomplish. So I guess we'll just have to all wait and see. First, as you say, who the lay administrator is going to be to take care of the daily business, so to speak, of the Diocese of Gary, but who the Pope is going to choose to fill the position of bishop here when the time comes. Carol Carlson is the reporter covering news in the city of Gary and elsewhere for the Post-Tribune, and we really thank you for spending some time with us today.
Thank you, Chris.
Talk to you again soon. Take
okay,
care.
Bye-bye.
Continuing on now with Regionally Speaking's Reporters Roundtable Thursday, let's check in with Joseph Pete. He's the business and sometimes other reporter, too, for the Times of Northwest Indiana. Joe, thanks for being with us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
We've got a nice mix of stories here that are not only business-related, but the first one is economic development-related. Fill us in on, I guess, we're waiting to find out from the city of Gary about what they want to do about the Lake Street project, the Lake Street Beach project, excuse me, in the Miller neighborhood. Tell us what the latest is there.
Yes, there's been a push in recent years to kind of put more attractions along the Lake Michigan lakeshore. You've seen Whiting has been trying to develop a fine dining restaurant. Michigan City put in that pavilion where, you know, you can get rooftop cocktails and that type of thing. And then Gary is kind of looking to try to maximize the tourist visitation to its lakefront, especially with the designation of the Indiana Dunes National Park. And they have been looking into bringing a private developer to develop some type of attraction that would be open to the public on the Lake Street Beach. They're interested in something like a wedding venue, a banquet hall with lakefront views, fine dining restaurant, cocktail lounge, hotel, something of that, the project of that nature. And they have been working with different developers. They're originally looking at, I believe, like a 96-acre site at the end of Lake Street and Miller. There was concern about, developing over some of the natural land. So they had they're only going to develop a 21-acre site. They're going to keep and preserve the natural land and trails as they are. The only thing they're going to build on is the old Naval Armory site that was most recently the Charter School of the Dunes and the two beach parking lots there. That has raised some concerns. A lot of people, that's where they go when they go to the beach in Miller. Is parked there on Lake Street. They'll leave a limited amount of parking at like Marquette Park. You'd have to go further east to find parking, but they're looking at trying to bring some kind of attraction to that site. They had put out a request for proposals. They're looking for, I believe, $4.25 million from a private developer to purchase that land and put in something that would like make it more of a draw. They did that earlier this year, but the first request for proposals went out, and they didn't hear anything back. They haven't had nothing from developers. There was a developer they had been working with previously, on that site, but they already kind of backed out earlier, and they We're not going forward with the project, but now Gary is kind of taking a step back. I believe there's a period, like a waiting period of, it's 30 to 60 days or so. There's a statutory period where they can't really do anything. But at that point, then they're going to, you know, listen to see if any developers approach them and come to them with any ideas. They're just trying to look at some kind of pedestrian-friendly tourist type business. They've even suggested things like a museum or science center, but it's really hard to say what the private sector would have interest in doing at that time.
You had a chance to talk, I know, with Gary Redevelopment Director H.J. Bittner about this and from the meetings as well, too. Do you get the impression that with all the other redevelopment projects in the city of Gary, this one is kind of on a fast track, that they would really like to get the Miller area on the way, get something done and get something, that would in turn benefit probably the Indiana Dunes National Park?
Yes. Well, there is a lot going on with Miller. There's, of course, a healthy business corridor there on Lake Street. And then the South Shore double tracking project is coming up. They're expecting some mixed-use redevelopment when they make some improvements to the South Shore Line station there. And then also they had just started the project on Lake Street where they're completely rebuilding Lake Street. They're redesigning it so you have bike lanes that would go basically from, you know, you'd be able to take the train in from Chicago, get off the train, ride a bike all the way out to the beach, and they're putting in the bike lanes, they're replacing the angled parking with parallel parking, and they're completely, you know, rebuilding the street there. So there is a significant amount of investment and projects going into Miller, and they thought this would potentially complement it. That, however, might affect the timing, because a lot of developers might not want to put something in right away when, you know, it get off to a slow start because of a lot of road construction that would still need to be wrapped up. So that could have been one thing affecting it. Out of all the redevelopment projects, there's, you know, you're talking about prime Lake Michigan Lakefront. This one is a very popular wedding venue, the Gary Bathing Beach Aquatorium. It's usually booked about 2 years in advance, including in the winter when, you know, it's very cold on the on the lake there. But, you know, this one potentially would have the most potential from the viewpoint of developers because you're just on the water there. So,
yeah, the Aquatorium in particular, that's a nice place because it's all enclosed in glass, but you still have the view of the dunes and the rest of the park and all in the lake as well. So it's, I can understand why people find that very, very attractive and they'd like to have events out there if they possibly can. Not surprising. One of the other stories that you had as well, too, kind of follows through on not only the lake and the concerns we have about the ecology, but also, too, about a company that's based in Valparaiso that's been in the news here not long ago. We know that there's always concern about straws that end up all this mess of plastic that end up in the ocean, and it all comes, of course, from things that get thrown in instead of reused, and this company in Valparaiso is interested in not only, I guess, doing their business, so to speak, but also about contributing to the worldwide cleanup of the beaches. Tell us about that.
Yes, there is a Valparaiso-based company that focuses on making reusable metal straws to replace disposable plastic straws. That's an issue that's really taken off with a lot of sudden speed and rapidity. This year, you've seen a lot of places switch to plastic or paper straws. You had some viral videos of sea turtles getting caught with straws and their concerns about what they do to wildlife, to seagulls, to aquatic life, because they don't biodegrade for hundreds or thousands of years or whatever, and there's concern that they're so light they get blown out of landfills, they get blown out of trucks. A lot of them end up in creeks, rivers, lakes, and oceans, and there is a Valparaiso company that's directly been trying to address this. It's Mermaid Straws. It's a husband and wife duo, Lisa Harrington and Adam Harrington. She'd been a real estate agent, and they're looking to branch out into something else. And they launched this company. It's pretty much, they're an online retailer. They've sold straws, metal straws, in all 50 states and worldwide, including in Australia, which is where he's from. But they are looking to kind of, they said the amount of straws they've sold so far have eliminated something like 35 million single-use plastic straws. And you see this a lot with millennial businesses. It's very mission-driven. It's not strictly, they're not strictly doing it to, gain a profit. It's also serving a higher purpose. And one thing as part of that, this weekend on Sunday at Porter Beach in the Indiana Dunes National Park, they will be staging a cleanup They're going to be staging a beach cleanup from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., and they're trying to turn it into like a worldwide cleanup event of beaches, parks, and neighborhoods. And they're encouraging people to, they've been really encouraging their customers to, you know, spend a couple hours cleaning up and tweet about it on social media with like hashtag mermaids draw cleanup, hashtag plastic free July. They're trying to kick off the plastic month of plastic free July, in which people, you know, cut back on their plastic use. But they are doing this as part of like their overall, you know, mission to kind of make the world a more environmentally sustainable place.
Well, it'll be interesting to see what kind of volunteer help they do get over there at Porter Beach for this weekend to do the cleanup. And if they want to do this on a regular basis, they'll get the word out. I'm certainly sure that if they've been doing a lot of online business, that they'll do a lot of promotion of the idea of doing the worldwide beach cleanup concept. So good luck to them on that. One of the other stories that you had in recently in the Times was about concern of child care and the expense of child care. And I mean, I guess people don't realize that sometimes it costs more to take care of a child than it does to send one to college.
Oh, absolutely. There's a study, recent study by Child Care of America. They do this annually. But they found that child care basically eats up more than 20% of the income of most married couples in Indiana with two children. And in the cases of like a single parent with two children, it can eat up more than 90% of the income, which pretty much forces them to turn to family options or that type of thing instead of professional child care. Mm-hmm. They have to look at other alternatives. This is a big issue because it affects like a lot of workforce and workforce participation. The child care costs have been, you know, skyrocketing nationwide, and it can really impair the ability to have two incomes in a household. They found that in Indiana, you have the average child care costs of $12,300 for center-based care and $6,800 for home-based care just one child. And if you have two child, it'll run more than $21,000. It's very expensive and a burden on the budgets of many Hoosier families.
Mm-hmm. You had a chance to do some breakout for Northwest Indiana as well, too. What did you find on the cost of child care there?
Yes, in Northwest Indiana, it was lower than a lot of the rest of the state, but it's still relatively high. In Lake County, it is running with one child around $9,600 to $17,900 for two children. If you've got like an infant and a 4-year-old, and then it's accounting for as much as 21.8% of a married family or the income of a married family with two young kids. In Porter County, it's running between $11,500 at a center to nearly $20,000 at a center. More than 20% of the income if you're a married family with two kids, and it's a little bit lower in LaPorte County. It's about a center around $8,300 to $15,200. But it's roughly you're going to have to set aside a fifth of your income for these expenses, which is the strain on many families.
Well, we can't pass up an opportunity to talk with you, Joe, about the stories that you've covered in print and online without taking a look at food, because we know that's probably your number two favorite subject aside from your spouse. Lou Malnati's is coming to town. If you didn't know that already, you haven't been reading Joe Pete's story in the Times, to be sure. But July 15th, it's not very many days away that he's going to show up with a new store in the region, right?
Yes, it is true that I am one of the world's foremost authorities on deep dish pizza. But there has been a keen amount of interest in this. I read about a lot of new restaurants opening and coming to the region, and I've never been sort of pestered isn't really the word, but a lot of people have asked for follow-ups on this story and wanted to know what's going on and how soon it's going to open. And Lou Malnati is kind of considered one of the big the big Chicago deep dish specialists, along with like Pequod's and Uno's and Giordano's and Chino East. And you do have a lot of like deep dish places in Cherryville already. You've got Giordano's, of course, Rosati's, Aurelio's, Giuseppe's, but a lot of people are eagerly awaiting the Lou Malnati's entry into the Northwest Indiana market. They're going to take over the old space, the Gaiety space in Cherryville at US 41, and it's Indianapolis Boulevard. It's basically at the border of Highland and Cherryville. They're starting with a to-go. It's going to be just a to-go and delivery restaurant. but it's potentially the first of a few locations because they have been rapidly expanding. They did get some private capital to kind of fuel an expansion. They've been adding locations all across Chicagoland. And strangely, they have multiple locations in Chicagoland and a few in Arizona, but none anywhere else for the time being. But they've been, they're up to nearly 60 locations now, and they've just been growing left and right. And, potentially, hopefully, they'll bring a sit-down restaurant here.
Yeah.
But with the Schererville on there, they're aiming for sometime after July 4th. They're tentatively hoping for July 15th. But, that depends on the permitting and a lot of the, they got to clear a lot of the bureaucratic hurdles. And so you never know exactly, when that's going to be. You have to have the fire marshal come out and all those things. And that's really outside of your control. But they're really hoping sometime in mid-July that it'll finally be open and people will be able to get their deep dish on.
I know that you've been focusing, of course, here on Lubonades because it's a story that you've been working on. You keep getting all these questions from avid readers, not only online, but also the print readers, too. But I wonder, and maybe you have thought about this, too, what about the impact this is going to have? You kind of alluded to the other pizza joints in the region, but we know not very far away is a very popular place. In fact, right across the street is the Tomato Bar. Which is a local one. They are based in Valparaiso, I know, and then they came to Northwest Indiana, I guess, at least to Schererville, and really picked up some business. I wonder if they're kind of girding their loins, so to speak, for the assault of Lou Malnati.
Yeah, in this case, I'm not sure that it'll affect them too much because they're more of a sit-down restaurant, and they're also kind of a new American, California American contemporary pizza style, whereas Lou Malnati's for the time being will be catering mainly toward takeout and to go. There does seem to be, the market is only of a certain size, but we do have like a million pizza places in Northwest Indiana, and we do seem to have a pretty insatiable appetite for it. I'm sure, it'll affect some of the other ones, but I think that it'll probably affect more of the places that deliver. It'll take away a little bit more of their market share. The one is more kind of oriented toward dining out, especially family dining. It's actually a pretty fun place. Like, they've hidden action figures throughout that tomato bar so that, if your kids are there, they can kind of look around, scan around the restaurant and see if they can, spot a G.I. Joe or whatever.
Yeah.
But it seems to be different enough where they'll probably be okay. But, it'll affect, places like State Line Pizza or they might see a little bit of a drop-off if people are going to Lou Malnati's instead. But pizza, it's a pretty, the thing with pizza, I've been told by some of the pizza restaurant operators, is that it tends to be a very sticky business. Like, people will go to different places and try different pizzas, but they tend to have their favorite that they fall back on.
Oh, yeah.
So a lot of people are already kind of established in their habits, and they, obviously they know Lou Malnati's, they'll go to Lou Malnati's. But if people are already have a favorite, Aurelio's is where they go, they're going to keep going there. They might go to, Lou Malnati's a few times, but I don't think it's going to put anywhere out of business.
Yeah, they'll try them out to see, like you say, what they're like, and they'll come back. They'll be back eventually. So I'm sure they're not terribly worried. So Joe Pizzas covers business news primarily for the Times, but other stories too. And Joe, as always, thank you for spending time with us to share the stories, and we'll be looking forward for the latest update on the Lou Malnati story as it comes down. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking here on Lakeshore Public Radio. The Hoosier State Line will make its final trip from Indianapolis to Chicago on Sunday. The governor eliminated $3 million in annual funding for the passenger train route in the two-year state budget that begins on July 1st. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barbara Brozier reports that while riders are sad to see the service go, the state says the numbers speak for themselves.
Business class, watch your step.
It's still dark outside in Indianapolis as people board an Amtrak train just before 6 a.m. The conductor says 67 people are getting on. This will be one of the last trips on the Hoosier State Line. Aubrey Hernandez says she's taken the train a few times, and she's disappointed the state cut funding.
It's kind of crappy because the train is needed for transportation, especially people that don't have cars, and need to get from state to state like in a quick 3-4 hours.
But the Hoosier State Lines faced uncertainty for years. The state started subsidizing the service in 2013 after Congress halted federal funding for all regional trains, while a spokesperson for the Indiana Department of Transportation says there have been improvements in on-time performance and services offered on board since then. Ridership keeps dropping. Amtrak data shows it's down by about 25% since 2013. NDOT declined to do an interview for this story, but spokesperson Scott Manning says in a statement, the Hoosier State remains one of the most heavily subsidized passenger rail services currently operating, with about 75% of the cost of each ticket sold subsidized by the state and local governments. This financial model is not sustainable in the long term and doesn't represent the best value for taxpayers. Chicago-based Amtrak spokesperson Mark Maglieri says the state's failed to make the necessary infrastructure improvements needed to increase reliability and frequency of the Hoosier State Line.
This train has been under a guillotine in Indiana for many years. And during this time, we've continuously told NDOT, as we've told the communities on the route and the advocates, there needs to be investment in this route for this route to be successful.
That's what leaders in many communities along the route would like to see, too. Crawfordsville Mayor Todd Barton says he understands why the state pulled funding, but sees the decision as short-sighted. Having a train from his city to Chicago has been an incentive for businesses to expand to the area. Barton says he wants to see the state prioritize train travel by creating a department that focuses solely on passenger rail, rather than including it as part of NDOT's responsibilities.
Departments of transportation are really focused on roadways and you know, moving commerce in that way, and there's really not a much of a focus or even a lobbying effort on the behalf of passenger rail.
While ridership numbers for the Hoosier State Line may not be strong enough for the state, Indiana Passenger Rail Alliance board member Todd Basler insists Indiana residents are hungry for more train travel. I meet him inside the Crown Plaza Hotel in Indianapolis, which is housed in a portion of historic Union Station. It was actually the first Union Station in the country when it opened, and at times had as many as 150 trains arriving and departing per day. The small Amtrak and Greyhound hub across the street is a far cry from what Indiana train travel once was.
Here we are, crossroads of America, right in the middle of everything. And we really need to pick it up a notch in order to be competitive.
Basler says he's encouraged to see the state investing in the South Shore commuter rail in northern Indiana and hopes the same can happen elsewhere in the state.
We've regularly spoke about what we call an inverted Y, which would be a daily reliable service between Cincinnati, Indianapolis, Louisville, Indianapolis, Chicago.
But a robust expansion is hard to imagine, with service from Indianapolis to Chicago getting scaled back. Once the Hoosier State ends, people can still take the Cardinal Line from Indianapolis to Chicago. But that train originates in New York and only runs 3 days a week. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barbara Brozier.
Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton put in a feature that aired on NPR during Morning Edition today.
Genetically modified salmon might be on menus in this country soon. The fish would be the first GMO animal approved for human consumption in this country. And as Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton reports, the fish are being raised in a very unlikely place.
Thousands of salmon eggs are sitting in a shallow pool of water on a late spring day. But these eggs aren't growing in a stream. They're sitting in trays inside incubators in a cool, dimly lit room. Some are just beginning to hatch.
So the eggs are about the size of a sweet pea, and then when the alvin hatches, it'll end up being about the length of your thumbnail.
That's farm manager Pete Bowyer. These eggs are growing in a lab nestled between farmland along a back road in central Indiana. The landlocked facility is run by Aqua Bounty Technologies and consists of several warehouses, some with dozens of big round tanks that look like swimming pools sitting in neat rows indoors. Sylvia Wolf says by being land-based, her company addresses two big concerns: creating sustainable fishing and getting fresh seafood closer to consumers.
We import about 335 million metric tons from Chile and Norway. This gives us the opportunity to raise salmon close to consumption, reducing the carbon footprint.
The salmon Aqua Bounty are raising for the U.S. market had to first clear hurdles with the Food and Drug Administration. The company edited the genes of the salmon to shorten the time it takes to be fully grown. Outdoors, that takes about 2 years. But Aqua Bounty says it can produce marketable salmon in about a year and a half that will be the first genetically engineered animal sold to Americans for human consumption. Bob Brody researches aquaculture at Purdue University. He says that most of the salmon sold today is grown in net pens in the ocean and that raises a number of concerns.
There's a lot of worries about environmental impact. There's a lot of worries about disease issues, escapes, that sort of thing in those systems. So a lot of people are looking at land-based aquaculture to reduce some of those environmental hazards.
He says the challenge has been making land-based aquaculture profitable. Sylvia Wolf says these fish will be raised much closer to consumers and be competitively priced.
Well, I think that it is identical to Atlantic salmon, and so we're going to price it to what it is identical to.
While the fish won't be ready for a while, some businesses and restaurants are already deciding against selling them because of the GMO stigma. Kirsten Serrano and her husband own the restaurant La Scala in Lafayette, Indiana. She has ethical concerns about gene editing food.
I definitely want to say no to GMOs. I think that, you know, local is fantastic. The farm-to-table movement is fantastic. You know, we are a farm-to-table restaurant, but local doesn't trump everything. You know, you still need to look at sourcing and quality.
But Chef Caleb Churchill, who owns a restaurant close to the salmon facility, says he's interested to serve the fish, but ultimately it will be his customers that decide.
I think a lot of people that are chefs will entertainment, but be very cautious about putting it on their menu. You know, we're the middleman, I think, is the way you got to kind of look at it.
If he does put it on the menu, Churchill says he will note the fish is genetically engineered. If all goes well, the first batch of nearly 100,000 genetically engineered salmon could reach the market by late next year. For NPR News, I'm Samantha Horton.
And that's it for Regionally Speaking, Reporters Roundtable Thursday. I'm Chris Nolte. Our thanks to reporters Meredith Colias-Pete and Carol Carlson with the Post Tribune, and Joseph Pete from The Times, and also to our IPBS reporters as well, too. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you very much for being with us, and we'll be back with you on Monday.